Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Dan Snow's History Hit. In 1599, a group of men met in a pub in a small city in a small kingdom on the very edge of Eurasia. They want to talk about trade with the mighty empires of the East. There have been recent discoveries of sea routes to Asia. There have been advances in ship technology. And together, those meant that such a trade with Asia was now practical. After a few attempts, they convinced their aged queen to give them a royal charter. And on the 31st of December, 1600, the East India Company came into being. It was one of the last significant acts of Queen Elizabeth I of England. She had given royal sanction for her seafaring subjects to head east, and no one could possibly have imagined what the next 3 centuries would bring. 8 years later, 1608, small company ships docked in Surat in Gujarat. We think one of the ships, the Hector, may have been commanded by William Hawkins, who came from seafaring aristocracy. He was the nephew of the legendary sea dog Sir John Hawkins, who had helped redesign English naval vessels and then led those ships against the Spanish Armada in 1588, alongside his cousin, Sir Francis Drake. Hawkins headed inland to meet the ruler of this mighty empire, Jahangir, among whose many titles was most mighty of authority and master king. He ruled over a vast empire that spread from the Himalayas to the far south of the Indian Peninsula. He traced his lineage back to Genghis Khan. To him, Western merchants were supplicants, begging favors from a ruler of unimaginable wealth and power. The mission was a success. Hawkins brought back a cargo which made the investors a huge profit. There were follow-up missions. In 1615, King James I instructed Sir Thomas Rowe to visit the Mughal emperor to arrange for a commercial treaty that would give the company the exclusive right to live and establish warehouses in Surat and other areas. Jahangir wrote a friendly letter to James I. "Upon the assurance of your royal love, I have given my general command to all the kingdoms and ports of my dominions to receive all the merchants of the English nation as the subjects of my friend, that in what place soever they choose to live, they may have free liberty without any restraint. For confirmation of our love and friendship, I desire your majesty to command your merchant to bring in their ships all sorts of rarities and rich goods fit for my palace, and that you should be pleased to send me your royal letters by every opportunity, that I may rejoice in your health and prosperous affairs, that our friendship may be interchanged and eternal." This, as it turns out, would be an optimistic view of the future bilateral relations between the two states. Over the centuries that followed, what had begun as this very unequal trading relationship transformed. In fact, it inverted. Within a century and a half, the British found themselves in a position of power in India. They could make war. It conquered. And eventually they even forced the Mughal emperor, the descendant of Jahangir, to do their bidding. That friendship proved not to be eternal. Over the next 2 episodes, I'm going to be telling the story of the English and British in India. I've got Shrabani Basu back on the podcast. She's been on before. She's the author of many wonderful history books like Victoria and Abdul, which was then made into a smash hit movie. Over two episodes, she's going to talk me through one of the most unlikeliest stories in history. And this is the beginning. Enjoy. Shrabani, thank you for coming on the podcast to take on this massive, massive task.
It's wonderful to be here, Dan, and this is my favorite subject, so I'm happy to do this.
We're gonna rattle through a couple of hundred years of history. Mm-hmm. We should start, shouldn't we, by talking about the Mughals, the people that came before British India and whose decline is totally wrapped up in the rise of the East India Company and the English and British in India. An extraordinarily powerful dynasty, a good run of monarchs they had, didn't they? Should we start with, is it Babur?
It's Babur, definitely. So his full name is Zahiruddin Babur, and Babur, of course, stands for tiger. So that's him.
And we should say not Indian as we would understand it.
Not at all, actually. Really interesting heritage because he is born in the Fergana Valley, which is in present-day Uzbekistan. And he inherits the throne at the age of 12. His ancestors are really important. So these are familiar names from history. From his father's side, he's a direct descendant of Timur, who was the fierce warlord from Turco and Mongolian regions. And from his mother's side, this is even more fierce, he is descended from Genghis Khan.
So he has the blood of Timur and Genghis in his veins.
Exactly. And so there is a lot of Mongol descent, Turkish descent. And in fact, the word Mughal actually comes from the word Mongol because they are descended from the Mongols.
And they are Islamic. They're Muslim.
They are Muslim. Right. And of course, Babur is 12 when he comes to the throne. He loses his kingdom immediately. He conquers Samarkand and then he sort of consolidates himself and he looks east. So his first major conquest is in 1504 when he conquers Kabul. And this is big because now he settles in Kabul. He consolidates his power. And he says, well, forget Samarkand, forget Fergana. That's gone. And he wants to look east over these mountains. Hindu Kush and India awaits him. So he's going to go east from now on.
And so he conquers much of what we would call India today. Well, Pakistan, India, and Bangladesh.
Of course.
And this is the Mughal dynasty. Extraordinary architectural legacy, artistic, probably one of the greatest powers on earth through the 16th century.
Absolutely. I mean, he hasn't started the dynasty yet. It's going to start with this battle, very crucial battle in 1526, where he defeats Ibrahim Lodi. So at this moment, India is ruled by the Sultans of Delhi. This is North India. And you see these Lodi monuments all over Delhi. People are quite familiar with them. Beautiful architecture. But Babur comes, he defeats the Ibrahim Lodi, and this is where he sets up the Mughal Empire. And this Mughal Empire is going to last for 300 years. It has six of the most well-known kings that are going to, you know, go through this line. And of course, the architecture, the culture, the architecture, it's the Red Fort in Delhi, the Taj Mahal in Agra, all these are Mughal contributions.
And his son, Humayun, I visited his tomb in Delhi, right? And that's astonishing.
It is beautiful. It's been restored recently. And you can see the beginnings of the Taj Mahal. It's actually a sort of miniature Taj Mahal. It's just not in marble. And it is beautiful. The grounds are beautiful. So this is the beginning of the Mughal sort of dynasty starting in India, laying its roots. And Humayun is actually really important. Babur, he dies quite quickly. He just has 4 years in Agra and Delhi. Humayun inherits. But Humayun, he extends the empire, but he has two fierce rivals to meet, and they are from East India. So there is the Sur dynasty, and Sher Shah Suri famously laid down the Grand Trunk Road in India. So he meets him in battle, and he's defeated. And so Humayun has to leave Delhi, and he flees to Persia. This is important because he spends 15 years in Persia. And he really imbibes the culture. So what he brings back later is this Persian culture, which is so much there, as we see in the Mughal texts, in the Mughal architecture, because all these are with Persian influences. And quite importantly, while he's on his way, it's a really hard journey, and he's with his wife. He's sheltered by a Hindu Maharaja, and his wife gives birth to Akbar in the house of a Hindu king. And Akbar is going to be one of the greatest Mughal rulers, one of the most famous.
And Akbar, he becomes Akbar the Great.
He is.
We're already giving a sense here, we're jumping around a bit, but of the cultural and the religious and the kind of ethnic complexity and exchange in this period. And this is why modern Indian nationalists have started to sort of paint the Mughals as in some way foreign, right? Not Indian, essentially.
Well, it's their view, but I wouldn't. They are Indian. They bring cultures to India and they live in India. The taxes that they raise, unlike later on, are not sent back to some other country. They're not sent to Persia. The taxes are used in India. So they are Indian in every sense. And I think they've made the biggest contribution as well. So, you know, we have a lot to thank the Mughals for.
And so we've got Akbar. He's remembered as, is this the sort of pinnacle of Mughal power? It's a vast empire.
It is. Akbar is known as a really enlightened ruler. He's Akbar the Great. He actually makes marriage alliances with other Hindu rulers. He extends the empire. He himself marries a Hindu princess, Jotabai. And, you know, visitors to Agra can see it in Sikandra, where he's made Jotabai's fort. He's very interesting because he also starts a new religion. It's called the Deen-e-Ilahi, and he wants to bring the best of Hinduism and Islam together. He's got a different outlook. He's very enlightened. And of course, he encourages the art. So he goes down as one of the best known Mughal emperors.
Very few hereditary systems ever get it right. In fact, none of them do by their nature. But the Mughals had particularly difficult succession crises, didn't they? Just briefly, let's talk about that.
Well, it's always blood of thrones when it comes to royalty, you know. Everyone is slaughtering everybody getting in there. But the first six are going quite smoothly. I think the real battle happens when Aurangzeb.
But there's a few brothers getting killed, aren't there? And a few...
A few along the way.
Yeah, a few, okay. So it's not, but then again, you know, who am I to talk? The old Plantagenets were happy to hack a few pieces off each other. Okay, so we get, after we get Akbar, we get Jahangir, which has got the best, what's that nickname? It sort of means, it's his cognomen, his royal cognomen. It means sort of world Caesar or something. It's mm-hmm. unbelievable. Mm-hmm. I love it.
He is. There's this beautiful portrait of him holding the globe. Jahangir was somebody who loved beautiful objects. I mean, some of his stuff is in the V&A, his jade wine cup, for example, his throne, various things. But I do want to just divert for a moment, Dan, if I may, and talk about the Mughal women. Because, you know, when we talk about this enlightened culture, the women were also really enlightened. They were literate. So Humayun's wife had her own library. And Hamida Begum, her library, parts of the manuscripts are actually in the British Library with her seal on them. And they come out for exhibition sometimes. They're really beautiful to look at. His half-sister, Gulbadan, she was a writer. She wrote the first autobiography of a Mughal princess. So this dynasty, you know, very enlightened, very cultured and literate. Even the women, they are not secluded or anything of the sort.
And into this enlightened, cosmopolitan, advanced world, we get the English.
Yes.
Arriving on their wooden ships. Let's look at it from the Mughal point of view. Mm-hmm. Were they a nuisance? Were they an opportunity? Were they like Vikings? Were they worrying? Who are these people?
Well, first, they didn't really care about them at all. So the picture here is that they're latecomers to this party.
True.
So what we have in India, in South India, is, of course, the Portuguese have arrived. 1498, Vasco da Gama has arrived. He's arrived in Calicut. He gets off this boat, kisses the beach in Kapad, and the Portuguese then send back ships laden with spices, cloves, peppercorn. One load of peppercorn could pay for things for years. So he goes back with a huge booty and returns again. And of course, everybody else is interested. The Dutch are interested. Dutch are in there by 1605. They want cinnamon from Indonesia. They want pepper. Everyone wants the spices. And they set up little factories in Surat in West India by 1605. The British are nowhere there at this time. So, as you say, the first wooden, rickety wooden ship commanded by Captain William Hawkins, this arrives in 1608. He lands there and he wants to see Jahangir. Jahangir has the Portuguese sort of wooing him and he's not bothered. He keeps him waiting for 3 months. He does meet him, doesn't give anything. And then William Hawkins writes back to the king and he says, send better troops, send better gifts. You know, we've got to impress the emperor. So 1612, ship is sent with better gifts, more troops, and they defeat the Portuguese. So Jahangir wakes up. He says, there's a new player here.
And Jahangir is so powerful. But the Portuguese and the, and you mentioned that there are, when they're establishing these factories, they're carving out little toeholds. There's no suggestion they're going to conquer a big empire in India at this point. But why does Jahangir allow them to even have little bits like around Goa and little footholds? Or is it because those are parts of India that aren't under Mughal control?
Well, they're in the south. And also they probably give him things from Europe, which he loves. He's a collector. He loves these things, which is where Britain now cotton onto this, and they decide that they send their first ambassador, formal ambassador to Jahangir's court, they send Sir Thomas Roe. So he arrives in 1612, and Jahangir meets him. And there is a mural of this meeting where Sir Thomas Roe is presenting his credentials, and it's in Westminster Hall, so all visitors can see this. It's a beautiful mural. And of course, Jahangir now listens to Thomas Roe, and his request is that the British be allowed to start factories in Surat. And Jahangir gives in, and in exchange for that, he wants luxury goods from Europe. So they agree to do that.
And the English don't look like they're a threat to him.
Not at all. Yeah, they're a very minor power at this stage. But the English have discovered another thing at this stage, because they have been eating this wonderful food. In Surat, the merchants are feasting on the food from the Mughal kitchens. And they are instantly seduced. And Sir Thomas Roe himself, you know, he dines in Shah Jahan's palaces, and he says the fare that is served, there are like reams he writes about the courses, just the different types of rice and the meat. And I think this is the first encounter of the British with Indian food, and they are instantly seduced.
It was a love affair that has never come to an end.
Absolutely.
And so you've got these requests for so-called factories. They're basically warehouses, aren't they? And so Indian merchants can sell them lots of stuff. You can stockpile it all. And then when these very irregular, it takes a year to get there. So these very irregular ships turn up, it can all be loaded, and then they sail back. And we should say, of course, this isn't the English state, is it? This is a private company, so the East India Company. Do they dabble in local politics? Are they sort of trying to, I guess they're trying to protect their interests, right? And they might make sure the local ruler is paid off and friendly and all that kind of thing.
Absolutely. So basically it was when, you know, these merchants in London, they meet way back in 1599 and they see the Portuguese and the Dutch making this wealth in India. They know the spices can be, you know, a lucrative market. So they meet in this office in Leadenhall Street in the city of London and they set up the East India Company, which then in 1600 gets the Royal Charter from Queen Elizabeth I. I know we're going back a little bit here in history, but when she signs, this aging queen, she signs this, she has no idea that this is going to set up the British Empire. And it's, it's just a charter to a company to trade. So it's quite significant that, you know, turn of the century, then the British get in. It's only the spices that draw them to India. But soon, they need troops to keep these factories going, to win over the local leaders. And
yeah, what begins as a kind of security force for the factory.
Exactly.
Sort of turns into a little...
little mini army.
Mini army, and maybe get involved in little local squabbles, just on a regional, and then slowly, a bigger and bigger scale. But the Mughal at the moment, still... absolutely dominant force, and Jahangir followed by Shah Jahan.
Exactly. So Shah Jahan, who we all know with Taj Mahal, he allows the British further inroads. So now they start moving north. So this far they've been in Surat, which is West India in Gujarat. They're now moving north. They are allowed to trade in Calcutta.
So Bengal.
Bengal.
Which is fabulously wealthy.
They set up Fort William there. So troops and a little bit of presence is there in Fort William, Calcutta. And also, at this time, they've also got this dowry, very handy. Bombay has been given to them as a dowry for Catherine of Braganza's marriage to Charles II.
Yeah, so Charles II looking for a wife. The Portuguese have a spare princess and they send her along, and her dowry is Bombay.
Bombay. Who would have thought? Bombay at this time was nothing. It was just a swampy island, but that is going to become the financial capital later. So very important. You have Calcutta, one important dock. You have Bombay, you have Madras, you have Surat on the west. So the British are getting very important posts in India.
Yeah, very well placed.
Yeah.
Calcutta and Bombay, east and west, respectively.
Yeah.
Are they proving useful to the Mughals? I mean, is it quite nice for them to have this sort of pipeline to the west and get a bit of, you know, useful Western products and stuff? And
yeah. I mean, at this stage, they're not really too fussed about them. It's, you know, the Mughal Empire is so big. It's at the height of its power with Akbar, Jahangir, Shah Jahan. By now, it's at its pinnacle. And so these small traders are of no consequence at all. I mean, they don't know what's coming.
And the East India Company's paying. They're paying for their goods.
Yeah,
I mean, it's trade.
It's trade. Yeah. It's trade. In fact, by 1647, the company has 23 factories and settlements in India. So they are increasing their hold.
Aurangzeb follows Shah Jahan. He kills his brothers and topples his dad, you know, as is common.
Locks him up, really.
Locks him up, poor thing.
Locks him up in the Agra fort. It's from where he can see the Taj Mahal. Yeah. It's really tragic, but there we are.
Speaking of which, I love the huge mosque in Delhi that Shah Jahan built. I was there a couple of years ago.
Jama Masjid, yeah.
Extraordinary, yeah.
And the Red Fort.
And the Red Fort itself.
The Red Fort, Jama Masjid. These are all monuments, you know, that people just love in India, so yeah.
So Aurangzeb comes to power 1658.
Mm-hmm.
Possibly, well, I said the pinnacle earlier, but this is, by geographical extent, this might be the high point of Mughal power.
It is. Because after Aurangzeb, the Mughals go into decline. They do last all the way till 1857, when we have the last Mughal. But they are there as a minor power. And lots of their descendants are in power in, you know, scattered around India as well.
You listen to Dan Snow's History. We're talking about the British in India. More coming up.
I'm Professor Susanna Lipscomb, and on Not Just the Tudors from History Hit, I'm looking for answers to the big questions about every aspect of life in the early modern period. Like, how did the memory of Anne Boleyn continue to influence the court of her daughter, Elizabeth I? How were fairies brought to life on the Elizabethan stage? And how did the arrival of male-only doctors threaten the lives of women? In other words, not just the Tudors, but most definitely also the Tudors. Twice a week, every week. Subscribe now and follow me on Not Just the Tudors from History Hit, wherever you get your podcasts.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life? Aura frames are beautiful, Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It's super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving an Aura as a gift, you can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. And also remember, when you use a messaging app, they shrink the photos. You cannot print those out. You cannot blow them up. This is high quality imagery going to one of the most important people in your life. The Aura app is super easy to set up. It takes about 2 minutes and you're going to love it. There's free unlimited storage, add unlimited photos and videos, and invite as many people as you want to a frame. Right now, Aura has got a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting auraframes.com to get $30 plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's auraframes.com. Use code DANSNOW at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply. So yeah, under Aurangzeb, is this when it feels like both sides start to realize what could be at stake here? And I mean, he does fall out with East India. There are, you know, Mughal East India Company battles and things in this period, and they sort of have to beg forgiveness. But there's a sense of the power dynamic changing a bit, isn't there?
Mm-hmm. So Aurangzeb himself, his character is also important. He's a very strict Islamic ruler, and all the sort of the music and the literature of that court, he sort of frowns on that. He bans music and dance. So he's a very strict Islamic ruler. And of course, they're not doing him any favors. He fears they may be trying to convert, whatever. All these things are happening. And they clash with the East India Company. So basically, in 1686, we have the first Anglo-Mughal War. And the East India Company, they want more decrees, but they are being opposed by the Mughal forces. The Mughals even blockade Bombay, but the East India Company is defeated and they have to submit to Aurangzeb. And then we have this really interesting story, because in 1695, we have this English pirate, Henry Avery, and he attacks a Mughal treasure fleet, which is on its way back from Mecca. And he pillages thousands of pounds worth of treasure. But the East India Company has to apologize again. And they beg, they offer to pay reparations to the Mughals. So they have to eat humble pie with Aurangzeb for a bit. The relations are getting quite strained at this stage.
So in that first half of the 18th century, Aurangzeb's gone. You've got these, you've called the minor Mughals, poor things. I feel sorry for them now. But they have a series of challenges, not only these Europeans nibbling at the edges, but there's a Persian invasion, isn't there?
There is, under Nadir Shah. And it's famous because it's the sacking of Delhi. The civilian population is decimated and the loot from the Mughal court is taken, including, of course, the famous Kohinoor. So Nadir Shah takes this, and now the Kohinoor... This huge diamond, famous, the most famous diamond in the world, which is now in the Tower of London, part of the crown jewels. And he takes this. This used to be on Shah Jahan's throne. Shah Jahan had this beautiful peacock throne, and the Kohinoor was embedded in it. And then, of course, the minor Mughals, it went around. But finally, Nadir Shah takes it. He takes it by deceit. There's a big story about it. But one of the things he's got is the Kohinoor. And now the Kohinoor travels to Persia.
And so it's a perfect storm for the Mughals. It's slightly less than impressive individuals on the throne. Mm-hmm. It's Europeans with, you know, increasingly kind of interesting technological advantages as a result of the Industrial Revolution nibbling away at the edges. And then it's also a catastrophic invasion from the northeast, from Persia. So
exactly,
it's all going wrong.
It's going wrong and it's ripe for the picking because, you know, enter these men in red coats.
And then let's whiz forward a couple of decades to the middle of the 18th century, where we really see the emergence of, amazingly, the East India Company, but also other Europeans conquering chunks of land in the Indian subcontinent. And before we get to some of these extraordinary personalities, is this a sign that after Aurangzeb, the Mughal hold on the subcontinent, is it weakening?
It is weakening. So Aurangzeb is the last big Mughal emperor. After him, they're all minor Mughals. They don't have the land because they're losing the land. Many of the descendants, you know, have small principalities, smaller kingdoms. They're scattered around India. So yes, I mean, the Mughal power is on the decline, definitely, after Aurangzeb.
And so now the English and the French are sort of dealing more with what sort of devolve regional powers, mm-hmm. and I guess therefore less potent. So they think, well, we can manipulate these and perhaps eventually even conquer them.
Exactly. So they see a toehold and they see opportunity. And the East India Company is in. I mean, they're in Bengal at this stage. So they're just going to take it further. They want to keep going north, you know, get as much territory as possible. So we now come to Clive.
Yeah, and Robert Clive, so he goes out with the East India Company. His job is to turn a profit, right? His job wasn't to become a warlord and conquer lots of territory. So how does that all happen?
Well, Robert Clive, he's born in Shropshire, educated at Merchant Taylor School, and he joins the East India Company at the age of 19. As many people did, just to make a profit, he goes as a scribe. He's just a clerk in a company. But everybody who joins the East India Company, you know, they take this ship, they go there, it's all for profit. They know they will come back with money. And so does Clive. So he's very ambitious. He's sent to Madras, but soon Madras falls to the French. So he escapes and he joins the army. He joins the East India Company army. And he's noticed because he actually is a pretty good soldier. He has some victories in the south. He takes Madras And then he is sent up north. He is sent to Bengal.
The India you're describing feels like the sort of central control is weakening, and it's allowing these people, whether it's local Indian princes or the British and French, to sort of fight each other for the spoils, if you like.
Exactly. And there are local leaders who are important as well, local rulers. So in the south, you have the Marathas. Down south, you have, you know, Mysore kingdom. In Bengal, you have the Nawab Sirajuddaulah. And he basically tries to reconquer Calcutta. There's a siege of Calcutta.
So he tries to throw the East India Company out.
Basically, yes. And he takes over Fort William. And then we have this incident, which is known in history as the Black Hole of Calcutta, because the prisoners are locked up. It's extreme summer heat. They're locked up in this room. And 46 or so die out of suffocation and heat. And it's well known as the Black Hole of Calcutta. But of course, we don't know whether the Nawab personally ordered it or what happened. I mean, of course, these reports are exaggerated. It reaches Britain. There is this, you know, revenge has to be taken. And Clive is sent to Bengal. He takes back Fort William, so that's conquered. And then he goes upstream. He goes further up north to Sirajuddaulah's palace in Murshidabad. And here, there is this very significant, decisive battle fought. It's the 1757. It's called Battle of Plassey. And here, Clive defeats the forces of Sirajuddaulah.
Who's the local Indian?
He's the Nawab. He's local ruler, descendant from part of the Mughal family. And he was powerful. This Murshidabad palace is big, full of treasures. Bengal is rich. But Clive, it isn't actually a military victory because Clive does deals. So he basically does a deal with his commander-in-chief, who's called Mir Jafar, and a rich banker. Bankers always. So the banker called Jagat Seth, and they say that they will take away some of the army. You know, basically, they're just going to...
They'll sit on their hands.
Yeah.
And
Mir Jafar actually leads away a significant number of the troops from the battlefield. So it's easy. 3,000 of the company troops easily defeat Sirajuddaulah's 50,000 or more.
Through treachery and bribery.
Yeah. And in fact, you know, in the Indian lexicon, it's like doing a Mir Jafar is known as somebody who's a traitor. So it's something that still comes down. So Mir Jafar is then instated. I mean, that was the deal. He was going to be instated as the new Nawab. So Sirajuddaulah is captured. Mir Jafar, on a small pension, of course, controlled by the English, is made the Nawab of Bengal. And huge, huge reparations are paid to Clive. He's taken into the palace and said, take what you want. And he does.
So it's so interesting how the East India Company, it's a sort of slow process from wanting to protect their factories to getting involved a bit in local politics and moving into the hinterland to then putting one of their puppet candidates to be leader of Bengal.
Yes.
And then there's one obvious step after that, isn't there? Which is they just take control themselves.
Take control, yeah. So basically, now they have Bengal. And the next step is going to be this other battle, 1764. It's called the Battle of Buxar, in which some of the Mughal troops combine with other troops against the East India Company. And here, again, the East India Company troops defeat them decisively. And this is even more important in some ways, though. You know, the Battle of Plassey is literature written about it because that's the fall of Bengal. But 1764 is when the Brits now get the revenue. So this now allows them to be tax collectors.
Right, because in the deal that follows, the Mughal emperor says to the British, well, yes, you're now effectively my Bengali government.
Government, yes. So they're rulers now in Bengal. You know, you collect the taxes. And Bengal is not just the state of Bengal. Bengal is big. It's Bihar, Orissa. This is a huge province and rich. It's got a lot of wealth. So the taxes from there are going to...
And yeah, what's better than trading? And that is collecting taxes.
Exactly. So, you know, when we compare the Mughals with the East India Company, the Mughals, whatever tax they collected, the administration went back into the country.
It's the East India Company money. It's getting put on ships and taken to Britain.
Taken right here, all the stately homes.
Yeah.
And Clive himself, he takes away a fortune. But when he returns to India, he apparently comes back with something like 48 million. He takes away £300,000, which is now about equivalent of 48 million. And he's so wealthy. It's not just the money, it's jewels, it's everything else, that he buys himself a peerage. He's now Baron Clive of Plassey. He becomes an MP for as long as he lives, but he suffers from depression. And the end comes in his house in Berkeley Square, where he slits his throat.
Yeah, slits his own throat.
And that is the end of Clive of India.
Now, this is the bit that I find very interesting when historians discuss East India Company rule, because there are then a series of terrible famines in Bengal in particular through the late 18th century. And there's disagreement, isn't there, about whether does the East India Company being in charge, did it exacerbate the severity of those famines? Because if you've got even pretty shoddy local rulers, at least they're there and they're able to, you know, open up grain stores and... But the East India Company are making decisions from London, right? So you have to sort of write back to London. And these things are taking a year round trip to get the messages to get back and instructions coming. So you can't really respond as agilely.
Exactly. And, well, it's an exploitative regime. They are taxing the people of Bengal to the extreme. So hence, you know, you have this big famine, 1769 to 73. Estimates are that between 1 million to 10 million died in that famine. And that is purely because of the extortion from the East India Company.
Because these young folks going out being told they've got to hit their revenue targets, and they write back saying, well, there's a terrible famine, sorry. But, there's, you know, at the end of the day...
Yeah, they're just collecting. I mean, their sole motive is profit. And their sole motive is, you know, the shareholders' profit. So that's it. They're not interested. So it is complete exploitation, one-sided.
The East India Company is not going to stop with Bengal, is it? What happens? How does the whole of India end up falling into British hands?
Right. So right now they have Bengal. So that's in the East. So in Bengal, they've consolidated themselves. But the East India Company need more. And they are now going to face some rulers from the South who are very, very powerful. So one of them, they're the Maratha kingdom. And the other, the more significant one, is the kingdom of Mysore, which is in South India. Mysore is close to Bangalore, which people now know as the tech hub of India. So this Mysore is ruled by two rulers, Hyder Ali, who was actually a general in the Raja's court and then becomes ruler. And then he followed by his son, Tipu Sultan. And Hyder Ali... His battle strategy, everything was so famous that he is noticed by the founders of the American War of Independence. You know, they know Hyder Ali. They follow what he is doing against the British because so many things are going on. They are fighting their own war. So they are watching the tactics of Hyder Ali and later Tipu Sultan. And they actually name a ship, the Americans name a ship, Hyder Ali, after him, and they send it to fight the English. So on a global scale, a lot is happening. People are watching Tipu's kingdom. And after Hyder Ali, Tipu is really important. He is a powerful ruler. He's known as the Tiger of Mysore. And he loves the tiger emblem. So it's on his swords, it's on his throne, it's on everything. His flag, his emblem, everything
is on his famous mechanical toy, which has a tiger munching on a British red coat.
Yes, and it's in the Victoria and Albert Museum in the South Asian Gallery. So Tipu also reaches out to the French. It's quite interesting. He does international diplomacy on a big scale. So he wants the French to help him against the English. And he sends an embassy to Palace Versailles. And whatever Tipu is doing is being noticed and recorded by the Americans. So that's really interesting. So Thomas Jefferson writes letters saying this is what Tipu is doing. And he's keeping up with everything that Tipu is doing and, you know, making notes for their war to come with the English.
And Tipu Sultan inflicts defeats on the East India Company.
His nemesis is going to be a very famous man.
Unfortunately for him, Britain sends one of its best.
Arthur Wellesley, who actually at this time, well, he joined his brother Richard was the Governor General. He sends him to the South.
His brother Richard's the big smoke. Yes. And he gives his little brother a job.
Exactly. And so he sends him to the South, to Madras. Arthur Wellesley's doing his bit. But then he is sent to control Tipu. And this is the big battle, another of those dates that goes down in Indian history. 1799, Battle of Seringapatam, defeat of Tipu. Tipu is killed on the battlefield. And this is a big moment for the East India Company, because not only is Tipu defeated, his sons are then taken away by Lord Cornwallis, the Governor General. They are taken away to Calcutta, so there's no more rebellion. And it's quite brutal because they're all young, you know, and they're seized and taken away. And the family never returns to the south. But also what happens after that is that the East India Company troops just loot and plunder Tipu's rich wealth and his palaces. So his golden throne, he loved the tiger, so it has an emblem of the tiger. It's an octagonal throne with tiger heads on all sides. And that is actually broken up. It's broken into pieces and these finials are taken by different people. And the central one is sent to the king, and it's still at it's part of the royal collection. It lies in the vaults of Windsor Castle. And there's also the canopy for the throne. And on top of this golden canopy is this bird. It's called the Bird of Paradise. And it's encrusted with beautiful gems, emeralds, rubies, diamonds. And once again, this is also in the vault. It rarely comes out, but you can see it. It's on the brochure. It's a top picture of the brochure of the royal collection. Everything was taken. His swords with the tiger swords, you know, they're in Edinburgh Castle. They come up for auction every few years. Even his tent from the battlefield, that was taken with beautiful embroidery. That is now in Powis Castle. So it was looting, desecration of this whole Mysore Empire, and then another puppet ruler. The old Wadiyar dynasty that used to rule, they are sort of installed. A young king, Krishnaraja.
And so the East India Company, this is an incredibly complicated subject, but the East India Company is still technically a sort of separate from the British state, but through the 18th century, it's taken over by the British government.
It is, yeah. And it's actually also really interesting. Arthur Wellesley from here is supposed to have honed all his military strategy and tactics in India. So the Battle of Seringapatam, followed by another battle he has with the Marathas, Battle of Assaye, is apparently what gives him all the skills for Waterloo later.
And Napoleon wrote him off as a sepoy general, sepoy being the name for native Indian troops who were hired and then fought for the East India Company. But maybe being a sepoy general was exactly the right kind of training.
Yeah, and apparently he had this reverse hill tactic, so he would hide the artillery on the back of the hill and then they would come forward. And he sort of honed a defensive warfare. So step back, get in there and do the final, take over again. This charge.
Use the landscape to shelter your men until the final moment.
Yeah, yeah. And so he honed his tactics there and, of course, later went on.
We're reaching into this gallop through 200 years of history. In about 1800, let's say, the East India Company, this private company, albeit increasingly sort of controlled by government, but they are ruling over a good chunk of the subcontinent.
Absolutely. They're in the south. They are there in the east. They've got Bengal. So now they need to go north. Delhi and Punjab await.
And what is it like for Indians? Would they have noticed this change of government, the East India Company being sort of in charge? Or would these local puppets have made it feel like Indians were still in charge? Would normal people on the street and in the fields have noticed?
They would have noticed because some of them are being recruited as soldiers for the East India Company army. But more or less, it's still the Mughal Empire which they feel, you know, depending on where they are in the country. If it's north, it's still the Mughal Empire. Those are the rulers and they would be still looking to them, minor or not. That's the power they look at. And in other parts of the country, they are looking at their local rulers. But of course, Bengal is significant. Bengal is different because they're collecting taxes here. So I think in Bengal, they're not very popular at this stage.
So the people of Bengal would have known that the people in charge were these British people living in Calcutta. And it would have felt like a different world to living under the Mughals.
Oh, yes. Very ruthless. They would see them as ruthless, exploitative. And there's a lot of literature about the Battle of Plassey and the fall of Siraj-ud-Daulah. And as I said, you know, Mir Jafar has gone into, I mean, it's a term now for a traitor in India. It's fed into the local population, the psychology at that time, yeah.
Thank you very much. That is it for this episode, folks. Thank you very much indeed for listening. It is such an epic, epic tale. We're covering a lot of ground. In the next episode, we're going to take the British Empire in India to its zenith and its eventual collapse. Make sure you follow wherever you get your podcasts, and it will be directly delivered nice and fresh to your podcast feed. You won't have to do anything else. Thanks for Shravani for coming on. The story continues tomorrow.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dan Snow's History Hit. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us and you'll be doing us a big favor. Don't forget, you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of TV documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code DANSNOW at checkout.